From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. At a busy intersection in Watauga, Texas, sits a Conoco gas station where you can order grilled salmon or chicken Florentine along with a tank of unleaded. It's a hidden kitchen, and it's not the only one out there.
We really had tried to get a loan to buy a restaurant, and banks don't like to give loans for a restaurant. The banks were giving out loans left and right for convenience stores. So we decided, okay, we'll open up a gas station. On our specials board, we have duck a l'orange, lamb chops, stuffed New York strip, escargot. Come meet the chef.
I'm Francis Nweze from Nigeria. I'm cooking lamb, I'm cooking duck, I'm cooking shepherd's pie. It's not about location. If the food is wonderful, people will travel the distance to come. And here we are, inside a Conoco gas station in Watauga, Texas.
Hidden kitchens and the secret life of food in this hour. Let's head first to New York State. 30 miles outside Manhattan is one of the most innovative restaurants in the country. It's called Blue Hill at Stone Barns. And it's a restaurant literally on a farm, an organic farm with fields of produce, acres of greenhouses, and free-range livestock, all of which feed diners every night. Dan Barber, the chef at Blue Hill, believes we have an imperative to rebuild a sense of connection to where our food comes from. But it took a pig named Boris to teach him the true meaning of that mission. He told Ann Strangechamps the story, but I should warn you, it is not for the faint of heart.
The story of Boris begins about a year ago when I was standing on a hilltop watching our boar named Boris try and make love to one of the sows. He would sort of lunge at her to mount her, and she would scurry away. And this kind of went on for about 10 or 15 minutes. I had never seen this happen, and Craig, the livestock man, looked at me and said, "I think next week I'm going to have to shoot Boris." And I looked at him and said, "What do you mean shoot Boris? How could you shoot Boris? Boris, you know, was our man. He was our patriarchal figure on the farm. I mean, Boris, I should describe, was a 750-pound pig. I mean, he looks sort of dinosaurish in stature and just enormous. And I realized I never thought about this idea of, like, what do you do with a boar when he can no longer perform as a boar? We can't be the only farm in the world that deals with this problem. And it turns out that, in fact, we are sort of the only farm out there that deals with the problem because we are doing farming in a way that doesn't really happen anymore.
What Dan means is that no one uses boars to impregnate sows anymore. As Boris was all too obviously demonstrating, physical procreation in a farmyard is, well, it's messy and time-consuming and just way too inefficient. Almost 100% of the pork on our plates today comes from frozen semen. Even small farmers use what they call boars in a bottle. It's a kind of internet dating service for pigs that ships out boar semen overnight. No, the real problem Dan faced wasn't actually that he was so reluctant to have Boris put to death. I mean, he's a chef. Standing on that hillside, he looked at Boris, and what he saw was 750 pounds of pork.
I wanted the meat, you know? I wanted to work with this delicious, aged, luxuriously fatty meat. I mean, that is my business, right? So I did research on that, and it turns out that when you leave a boar, like Boris, to get that size, you create in their blood system something called boar taint, which essentially is tainted meat. It's smelly, really unappetizing. In fact, it's inedible. And this is from the testosterone coursing through the blood. And in fact, I called Bill Nyman, who started Nyman Ranch, and he said, historically, this is why pepperoni was invented. Because, you know, you always had all these boars, and no one knew what to do with them. And so if you added enough spices, wine, you would drown out this disgusting flavor.
I don't think I can ever eat pepperoni pizza again.
Yeah, I felt the same way. And I also felt like I didn't want, 750 pounds of pepperoni in the kitchen. I didn't know what I was going to do with that.
So at this point, Dan figured he had three options. Shoot Boris and bury him, slaughter him and let the slaughterhouse deal with the meat.
In which case it would get processed into, like, Alpo. And I had no interest in seeing Boris become dog meat, and none of the farmers did either.
Or option number three.
Castrate Boris And anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, you'll get rid of the boar taint. You'll have this delicious meat.
And what was wrong with that option?
Well, what was wrong with the option is that Boris's testicles were, you know, the size of like small basketballs. And Boris, at 750 pounds with these protruding tusks, was, you know, a monster.
Not only did no one at Stone Barns want to get anywhere near Boris's backside for this delicate operation, turns out there aren't any vets left to do that kind of thing either. Dan called up and down the coast of New England looking for one, and in the meantime, he began collecting opinions from everyone else on the farm.
What I discovered was, you know, probably the greatest case of transference I had ever experienced in my life. First of all, there was Craig himself, the guy who brought Boris with him to the farm, and he was married to a woman named Amy, who both of them together bought Boris. And in the divorce, he ended up taking Boris with him. And I got this sense from talking to Craig that there was part of him on some days that wanted to slit Boris's throat then and there and not even dig a hole for him, just throw him in the garbage heap. And there were other days when he would sort of caress Boris's back and say things like, "You're just the greatest pig in the world," and you know, was completely ambivalent about what to do. And I felt, and Craig sort of denies this, but I sort of read into it that, you know, there were still issues with his wife and with his marriage, and that Boris reminded him of you know, his happy marriage and his also, you know, ending of a bad marriage. And then there was Irene, who was the vice president of the company, has worked with me for 10 years. I've never seen her. She's never been angry at me. She's never been angry at anybody. And she stormed into my office like midway through this whole decision process and said, I just, you know, I'd like you to remember Sophie the sofa. And Sophie the sofa was a sow that we had on the farm about a year earlier. And she, it turned out, couldn't get pregnant. And she said, you know, it was discovered that she couldn't get pregnant. She was slaughtered within a week. And then she said, Boris hasn't gotten an erection in what, like 6 months? And for that, he becomes some kind of philosophical debate. And then she sort of like looked at me very seriously and said, "Don't you think there's something sexist about this?" And then, you know, then there was Jack, who's the vegetable farmer, right? And Jack, you know, stayed completely out of this issue because he's got a lot of issues with the way the meat people do their business. And he calls it the animal kingdom. I said the name Boris to him, and he just flipped around to me. And I'll never forget that he said, "A plus, numero uno, textbook, el stupido decision was to name your freaking boar. You know, you should have named him P22 or something like that, man. Once you name him, you are screwed. You get all sorts of attachment issues and all this stuff." So he went on. But, you know, I did what maybe my grandmother would have wanted me to do, which is I called a rabbi. He's a wonderful guy and very reformed, obviously, and loves pork. And I told him the story and I stopped and there was a pause on the phone. Finally said, "Tough one." And there was another long pause, and then he said that wasting the meat was not what the Talmud, if the Talmud could write about pork, not what the Talmud would have written. And he eventually called me back a week later and he said, "You know, I was thinking about it. I do think castration's the right option, but the sausage meat doesn't make itself worthy for that pain of castration if you don't donate 20% of the meat to a local homeless shelter." So I thought that was sort of a smart thing. So the question was, how do you find a vet? And we ended up finding this character, Dr. Steve Sanford. He said, "I bore 750. I never done that. I couldn't be more excited. You just pay for me and my wife to come for dinner the night before." I said, "What is this? You're bartering?" He said, "That's right, pal. Barter for the bulls." He set up what was like a small pharmacy company in his backup truck. The way Dr. Sanford said it is, "Boris is going to be Lucy in the sky." And then, you know, as I was laughing, he said, "But we're taking the diamonds." He went to work trying to figure out, like, how much smack, it was what he kept calling it. "I'm going to juice him with smack." And he kept giving these small injections, which Boris didn't even feel. And then finally, Boris sort of sat down and was kind of in an altered state. He was very awake. His eyes were open, but he didn't feel anything. And Dr. Sanford went with I don't want to be too graphic, but he went with a very small razor blade and extracted these two enormous testicles. Enormous. I mean, really the size of basketballs. And laid it on a towel next to Boris. And Boris really didn't feel anything. I mean, he didn't hardly even twitched.
6 months later, according to plan, Boris was slaughtered. 20% of his meat went to a homeless shelter, and from the rest, Dan made sausage. And after all this, the big question, for everyone in the kitchen and the dining room was, how would it taste?
You know, it would be tough for me to sit here and say, yeah, sausage was okay, it was pretty good. It wasn't great, it was fine, it was good. But the truth was, it was the best sausage meat I'd ever had. And I'm not the only one who felt that way. The ecstatic reaction from our diners, our customers, the phone calls, the emails, the letters we got was like nothing I'd ever been involved with. And I think there are two reasons for it. The first reason was aged meat like that, that has this complexity of fat, gets marbled in a way that, literally marbled, meaning the fat gets inserted in between the dry meat, and the flavor is really in the fat. So you were having a real culinary experience, and there was a physiological explanation for why his meat tasted good. But there's also a psychological explanation, and that's, you know, is revealed through the story. So that, you know, I was scared of the wrong thing. I was scared that people who knew Boris would be outraged that we had slaughtered him and made him into sausage. But in fact, the opposite reaction, and to me really stunning and revealing, was that people wanted to know about the whole thing. They wanted to know about the castration. They wanted to know about the slaughter. They wanted to know, you know, how much meat did it make? How was the meat different? And as they were asking these questions, they were eating Boris and in their own way, celebrating it. I'm sort of convinced now that at some point in our development as human beings, as eaters, we're hardwired for that. We're hardwired for stories, for sure. We all love a story, but we're all hardwired to sort of sit around the campfire and maybe as hunter-gatherers, you know, and try and understand what things are poisonous, what things are delicious, what things are nutritious. And that was sort of part of our evolution. Food companies now tell our stories, you know, and they tell a lot of lies, and they tell stories that we all know are untrue, and some of it can feel good, but most of it feels sort of empty, just like the flavor feels sort of empty. And I would say to anybody who's a cook, you have the opportunity around the table to use food and your experience of shopping for that food, or in our case, killing for the food. You have an opportunity to tell a story around the food that makes the food taste better.
Dan Barber is chef and owner of Blue Hill Restaurant in Manhattan and creative director of Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Tarrytown, New York. And Strange Champs prepared our story. Coming up, more stories about where our food comes from, including an apple orchard where novelist Jane Hamilton lives and dreams of apples.
You close your eyes and you go to sleep and you sort of see red and you're reaching and that's your night, and then you get up and you go do it. My husband's uncle always used to say, "Comfort me with love, for I am tired of apples." And we say that to each other at the end of the season.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes the food provides the story. Sometimes the story is the food. Writer Jane Hamilton has been feeding us stories for years. She's the author of the highly praised and best-selling novels The Book of Ruth, The Map of the World, and, most recently, When Madeline Was Young. What many of her fans don't know, however, is that Jane Hamilton has a day job, tending the orchards and selling the apples that she and her husband grow on their farm in Rochester, Wisconsin. Jane's favorite apples are the odd, the rare, the almost forgotten. Apples you can still find hidden in small family orchards on America's back roads, not in the supermarket.
There's the Honeycrisp, and this is going to be heresy to some, but I think the Honeycrisp tastes like a cross between the jicama and the Red Delicious. When I bite into it, I think this is a fully developed flavor of grocery store.
And I feel sad for the sort of delicate flavored, not so cool kids who are being left behind because the Honeycrisp is such a hot apple. They are incidentally about to develop another one called the Zest Star, which is hard to say, Zest Star. And I imagine the old guys coming into our apple barn and saying, the little lady wants some zesters. Because he's not going to pause to really say the whole word.
This is interesting to me because I am not in any way your equal in knowing apple varieties. But I remember years ago finding that same distaste for the Red Delicious when it was the most popular apple, or so it seemed to me when I went to stores.
Well, you know, I think growing the apples and being around them while they're being grown, you know, I've had the privilege of eating a Red Delicious when it's actually ripe, when it's tree ripened. And the apples that you eat in the grocery store are not tree ripe. And probably none of us know what a ripe Granny Smith is because they're picked green to ship. And they need a long growing season, so we can't grow them here. But, you know, a fully tree ripened Red Delicious isn't bad. And a tree-ripened Golden Delicious is exquisite. There's nothing like it. It's very delicate.
So what are your favorites?
This year it's the Spartan, which tastes exactly like red licorice, which I loathe. So
But you like the apple.
The apple, it's very sweet. It's very hard. It's very red and rosy. And, you know, you can imagine why they named it the Spartan, because it has endurance. It stays firm for a long time. Of course, they couldn't call it the Trojan, so they called it the Spartan. And it's a keeper.
What else?
Oh, I have something that I could say. And that is that one year the pickers were, they discovered a wild tree growing in the middle of the orchard. And so there was lots of discussion through the week of what this apple should be called. You know, they batted it around day after day, and it had a hint of strawberry flavor and a wild, slight bitterness. And so they finally came upon the name of Savage Strawberry, and they were well pleased.
You have favorites, obviously, but you said they change every year. This year it's the Spartan. Do you remember last year's?
I think I was going for the Black Willow Twig.
Now, what is the Black Willow Twig?
The Black Willow Twig is an antique variety, and it's the tree, first of all, looks like a willow, hence the name, and the branches sort of lope over in a graceful way, and they're thin. But it's a yellow-orangey, stripy apple, and it's very dry and tart. And some people cook with it, but I wouldn't recommend it because it really just doesn't juice up. It puffs up. And it's very strange. There's nothing, you know, there's a lot of Macintosh types, so you can say such and such is like the Macintosh, but there's nothing quite like the Black Willow Twig.
Except that it must be hard to introduce people to varieties of apples they haven't sampled.
It is true. It's like all things, we want the apples we know and are comfortable with. There's a wonderful variety that ripens in August called the Canadian Melba. And alas, it gets soft very quickly, but it's just got a wonderful sweet tart flavor. And we tend to make a lot of applesauce from it and freeze it, even though, of course, we have loads of apples that we could. But it's a very special flavor.
Do you ever worry that the variety of apples is diminishing? Are these older, special, different apples not being paid enough attention to?
Well, you know, there is a small subculture that for all kinds of fruits and vegetables are pushing the old varieties. So I think there will always be the fruit and vegetable geeks. But it's certainly, you know, when we go to market in the summer and there's the early varieties, it's so much harder to sell them. You have to talk so much to talk them up. But, you know, then when people discover them, they really discover them for life, and that's exciting. And their children, you know, we've been doing the Madison Market for, well, my husband has for, I think, over 35 years. So he's seen the generations, and then the children come who remember the Melba and they want to make sauce from it. So that's, you know, that's lovely.
What does this mean for you as a writer to live in the midst of all this variety? I can imagine that it must, I know you haven't written about apple orchards, but it is a kind of variety in life that must fuel the imagination.
One of the things I love about it is that it's, aside from the frenzy of the harvest, it's actually wonderfully quiet. And when I first came there, I labored under the illusion that nobody else was reading or writing. I was alone in the world doing this. And that was actually, for a 23-year-old who wanted to write, that was a good situation to find myself in. But yeah, the variety is wonderful. And just living in a place where you can watch the seasons turn is a wonderful reminder of who we are and what we need as human beings.
Jane Hamilton is the award-winning author of many novels, including A Map of the World and, most recently, When Madeline Was Young.
The tree of life my soul hath seen, laden with fruit and always green. The tree of life my soul hath seen, laden with fruit and always green. Trees of nature fruitless be compared to Christ, the apple tree.
And that's another Jane Sibbery, singing a 200-year-old American folk song, Jesus Christ, the apple tree. Some of the best stories about food have been brought to us in recent years by the award-winning public radio producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, better known as the Kitchen Sisters. Their stories about hidden kitchens are favorites of public radio listeners. They've got a whole new season of them coming up soon. They gave Anne Strainchamps a preview.
We say hidden kitchens are the secret, underground, unexpected, below-the-radar ways people cook around the country, how communities come together through food. And we've been looking for kitchen pioneers and visionaries and old stoves and the rites and rituals and traditions that glue communities together through food.
And a lot of this is disappearing, or so we've heard. And yet when we've been on the road looking around, there are a lot of new ones appearing and a lot of old ones being sustained. So I think in that way, even though it seems as if we're going to hell in the handbasket here on some levels in terms of food, communities do seem to be, you know, savoring and taking care of a lot of what they've done for years and years and years.
My name is Akemi Tamaribuchi, and I'm third generation Japanese American.
What are some of the latest hidden kitchens you found?
During World War II, my family
We're working on a story right now that'll be on Morning Edition in the coming months called Weenie Royale. And it's about the impact of the Japanese internment on Japanese cooking in America.
I'm positive that so many of the dishes that I grew up eating stemmed from what their resources were in camp and how they incorporated that into their tastes. They use things like ketchup and hot water for soup bases. Since then, we've sort of all just grown up with that taste, and we eat ketchup on everything. Weenie Royale and Hamburger Royale stand out in my mind because they're my favorites. Sunday mornings, we always had sliced hot dogs or ground beef mixed with eggs with soy sauce and sugar and a little oyster sauce stir-fried in with some onions over rice. So good. And you can find that in Sacramento, these small little hole in the walls. They will serve the home-style Japanese-American dishes.
We've just talked with a number of people that's just a regular part of the staple diet now is spam, sushi, and fried spam and fried bologna, and that's all a part of the traditional fare.
I was thinking sort of the moral of that story could be how bad food can taste good if there's a good story attached to it, except maybe spam sushi is really good.
I think it is.
If you go into Japantown here, I've been in Japantown recently, and if you go to all the old home-style restaurants, you'll see the spam on the rice and then also hot dogs on it. And it's just, I was watching it sort of fly off the counter. It was sort of to-go food. And everyone is always adapting. I mean, American cooking in particular is just this huge overlay of every immigrant. We were just in the Mississippi Delta doing a story about the Lebanese immigration and Lebanese cooking in the Mississippi Delta. And you go to Clarksdale, Mississippi, I mean, right literally at the crossroads where Robert Johnson played, you know, come on in my kitchen, and down to the crossroads and right across the street there in those same years, Abe opens a barbecue joint, and he's a Lebanese man, and they're serving traditional Southern barbecue. They're serving kibbeh. They're serving grape leaves. Still to this day, the first thing you see when you walk in this barbecue joint is a handwritten sign, stuffed grape leaves, you know, chicken fried steak and grits all mingling with Lebanese food and then black culture. And somehow these things coexist.
What about New York? I mean, that's a city that is so full of food. I mean, that you can't walk down a single street in New York without smelling food. A lot of your stories must have come from there.
We have one we love that we're sort of following to this day. A guy gave us a hot tip about in the Diamond District, in the diamond shops, in the way back or in the upstairs of these diamond stores, there are these restaurants. They call them these dairy restaurants. And they cook all kosher food. And they also are the gathering places where the two times a day when you need to have a minyan for prayer, the diamond merchants all gather and all the kind of Jews of the neighborhood come in and they pray together. And it's all kinds of Hasidic Jews mingling and having kreplach in the midst of more bling than you have ever heard.
And diamond conversation at every table.
Absolutely. Major diamond deals coming down.
It's called the Diamond Dairy. It's a kosher restaurant, you know. The clientele on the street are mostly diamond dealers. Diamond Dairy. On this street, it's like a small town. Everybody knows. Word gets out. Everybody has a friend, you know, who's on the street. Morning, young man. What can I do for you? Where do you get a good kosher meal in New York? They'll say, boom, up there. But the food is not bad, you know. You go into the kitchen, it looked like the grandmother of all Jewish grandmothers. And she's back there cooking. If you had to describe it, it's home style. In Jewish, it's called heimishit, which is home, you know. The coffee is weak. Jewish coffee is always weak. You want strong coffee, don't go to a Jewish restaurant.
Specials are eggplant, parmesan, bow ties and cabbage, noodles and cheese kreplach, cheese blintzes, which happen to be fantastic. The best in New York. My name is Wally Shafran. I've worked on this street for over 30 years. And I just love the food. That's it. I'm not kosher at all. Aren't the blintzes great? They're like feathers. Fantastic.
I was going to say, once you start thinking about hidden kitchens or hear just a couple of these stories, you start seeing them every place. I wonder if that's been your experience as well.
Absolutely. When we first began this series, Phyllis Richmond, who used to write the food column for the Washington Post, said, I look for handwritten signs on the side of the road. And it just opened up a universe to us. I mean, you don't think they're there, but if you start looking for either the handwritten signs or those sort of weirdly lettered signs that are on those sort of mobile billboards where they say potluck this Sunday, you know, you go to the car wash and you suddenly realize there's a little restaurant embedded in that car wash. You go to El Paso, Texas, and there's H&H Car Wash down on the border there. It's been there for 40
since the 50s.
Yeah, since the
1950s.
Since the 50s, and they are known for their hand wash cars and their Mexican food.
Carne picada, egg and chorizo, Mexican omelets, tacos,
burritos. H&H Car Wash. I've been coming 30 years, three times a week or whatever. Dusty Henson. Everybody eventually passes through here, and you'll see the mayor say next to the guy that drives the garbage truck.
It's like a friend, like a family.
My name's Maynard Haddad. My dad and me and my other brother opened this place October 58. One employee's been here 33 years.
Trabajo aquí por muchos años porque ellos han sido muy buenos patrones para mí.
Let me tell you a story about this lady, okay? She has three kids. Her first husband, tractor, ran over and killed him. Those three kids, they all have great jobs. They all own a home. Now, she raised these while she's working. And at that time, she was illegal, so she had to cross the river every morning. Border Patrol used to come and bust us when we had the illegals. They picked her up three times in one day. They picked her up, took her to the bridge, she came back to work. They picked her up, took her to the bridge, she came back to work. When you're hungry, you'll do whatever it takes to feed your family. That's what a lot of our public officials don't understand about being hungry.
H&H Car Wash is the soul and the heart of El Paso, Texas.
We call it Hidden Kitchen Vision, and I mean that's the other thing I would say. The Hidden Kitchen series has given us this vision of try everything. There's all this food out there, and you get in this sort of groove, this rut of what you eat and what you think's acceptable. And, oh, if someone said, I'm going to give you burgoo, it's going to have Boston butt, and it's going to have mutton, and it's going to have chicken, and it's going to have everything gleaned from the garden, you might think, I don't know if I like that mutton stew. Wait a cotton-picking minute here. You know what? You like burgoo. You just don't know it. And more than that, you like the whole story. It's like you're eating a story. And, you know, we're all just trying to sort of entertain each other. You know, we're all just trying to kind of make this journey through life a more intriguing and tasty ride and nourish each other and nourish our communities. So, yeah, I think once you start thinking this way, it does open up all kinds of vistas. We have a saying, what is it about men and meat and midnight and a pit?
My name is David Close, barbecue pit manufacturer here in Houston, Texas. This is what we call Bling Bling. It's a standard mobile pit, feeds about probably 600 people, 20-foot trailer, 7 foot wide. It's got 24-karat gold mags and handles. Had a friend of mine dip them, electroplate them in gold. It has a 2x4-foot sliding steak grill on the nose. And fish frying burner for doing, you know, deep frying turkeys and peanut oil. We've got an infrared grill that cooks at 2,000 degrees for nuke and cowboy steak. Behind that, you have gold sinks, 24-inch 3LMB satellite dish. It's got a DVR recorder that holds 100 motion pictures, DVD players, satellite radio, satellite TV. This is solar powered as well as electric power, so I can run the lights, the TV, radio, and all that off of the solar power. The lighting on the trailer will flash to the music. And we can even rig it where Jack Daniels and Coke comes out of the faucets. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to plan anything. You don't even have to have food. All I have to do is pull that pit up on a cul-de-sac and get out and light it. And people will start showing up with food, hay bales. People will party at the drop of a hat. The paint job on the trailer is a Ferrari Metal Flake Burgundy. Should last about 100 years. I could have had a Maserati or this barbecue pit. Now, what Texan would have picked the Maserati? None of them. This is forever. This is always going to be here. Maybe they'll find it hundreds of years from now and wonder what the hell this was, you know? I won't stop until I made everything in the world into a barbecue pit. I want one on the moon. I've talked to the administrator at NASA, you know? Ceramic fiber finish with platinum coils inside with solar panels, probably an oxygen-fixed environment inside. When people land, I want them to see the world's first close interplanetary grill. That sings. I'll give them the rest of the money I make the rest of my life if they'll put one on the moon for me. That, I mean, that's a scratch on the planet that you were here. The rest of it's moot.
You can catch the Kitchen Sisters' new collection of Hidden Kitchen Stories on your local public radio station. And for links to their book and CDs, you can visit our website, ttbook.org. Still to come, a trip downstream to an eel fishery in upstate New York. And a visit with a legendary cookbook editor, Judith Jones. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For years now, our technical director, Carill Owen, has eyed a small, handwritten sign by the side of Route 17, the road she takes to visit her parents in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York. The sign says simply, Eels and Smokehouse. This year, for the first time, she followed that sign and brought us back this portrait of its owner.
Ray Turner from Hancock, New York. I'm on the east branch of the Delaware River. I'm a commercial fisherman for eels. They're called Anguilla rostrata. They're nocturnal, so they move at night. And we're just kind of looking for a little kind of a drizzle and an increase in water elevation for our trap, which is about 800 yards upstream, 5 feet wide, 40 feet long, with 300 feet of rock wall rebuilt each year to funnel the buggers in. Now, they can be around here for as many as 25, 30 years or more, and then eventually prepare to go to the Sargasso Sea to spawn and die. My dad helped work it. Some other guys had it. I've been up there for over 20 years. I've been fishing this water ever since I could hold a line. That's where the fish trap is, okay? And it's in a rift, because you can see out here the water right out there in the channel is about 6 to 7 feet deep. The channel's on the other side of the river, and this is the shallow side, which makes it really nice for our egress in and out for commute. And that canoe right there, that old town, is that's my commute to work in the morning. And that is Eel Weir Hollow right there. First of all, you have to understand it's an ancient Native American style of fishing, and it's called an eel weir. And in hydraulics, a weir is when water flows over and drops down. That's a weir. Now, my weir is 5 feet wide, 40 feet long. Now, on each side, there are two walls that extend upstream for about 300 feet or more. So in essence, you've got a large V that funnels the fish towards the center, and then once they enter the vortex of the V itself, the hydraulic profile washes them up over the top of the latticework. But the fact that they're a nocturnal species, it's not all that safe to be out there in the middle of the night hauling the eels out when you've got flood stage and more of water going through the fish trap. So what I try to do is catch them as the river's rising. So if you get out there and you can get them before the water gets so high that it blows out the back of your trap, that's when the key haul is going to come in. And then hopefully we'll get the ton that we need to get through the year. There's a board called a lintel, which is a piece that, you know, kind of crowns the top. And I was looking down in it, you know, and there was nothing in it. And I looked up, and I looked right at the lintel, which was like, you know, a foot and a half in front of me. And I saw these little marks, like somebody took a tack hammer. It was just kind of puncturing the 2x4 just a little bit. And I noticed that it was wet. And I says, you know, something's been here. And lo and behold, it's exactly where the bald eagle was sitting the next morning, sitting there, standing on top of this lintel, a 3.5 foot tall bird. And it would just hang on to it, onto the lintel, and then take its other leg and just reach down in and try to grab me fish. So that's my competition. What we do is we'll harvest them from the river, and then what we do to kill them, we'll put about that many in a tank or a big tub. Then we'll dump 9 cups of salt on top of them, and it kills them. Those of you that have never picked up an eel don't realize how slimy they really are. But in the process of applying the salt, it breaks down the slime and it also kills them. Now, once they've been in there for about 45 minutes, we use a de-sliming processes, and then we go through our evisceration location, and then we'll go through the gutting process, and then we'll brine them. We use about 3 gallons of water to 6 cups of brown sugar, about a pound and a half of salt, and half a quart of dark fall honey. We smoke exclusively with apple wood that's harvested from the area, and then we take and achieve the 145 internal flesh temperature for a minimum of 30 minutes. You know, most people, they're looking for this free-range stuff, and these guys got the freest range of all times. They got the entire Delaware River to play in, and I consider them the best quality protein in the case. And right now there's probably maybe a dozen in here. And there's not many of us left that are doing this. I know old Floyd Canfield down in Coshecton, he's in the river, he's fishing this year. He's 71 years old and he's still doing it. He's been doing it for 45 years, 42 or 45. It changes every time I talk to him. But and then Doug Case has one down near Port Jervis, but those are the only guys I know besides myself that are actually doing this type of fishing. Now, that 300 feet of rock wall I was talking about up there, and then the whole fish trap, why would a man take on a job he knows he can't complete? Because the stone walls always can be bigger, taller, thicker. But you still have to fall prey to a basic philosophy for eel fishing. You're not there to stop the river. You're there to catch the eels. So That's what it is.
Ray Turner, the eel man. He lives on and fishes in the Delaware River near Hancock, New York, where he runs the Delaware Delicacies Smokehouse. Kirill Owen brought us his story. When Judith Jones was a child in the 1930s, her mother told her it was impolite, crude even, to talk about food at the dinner table. How far we've come in just a generation. Thanks in part to the efforts of this woman.
Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to my kitchen. I'm going to do some deviled eggs today, that stuffed, hard-boiled eggs. I just love them. Now, if you're going to do a whole
That's the legendary eggs, Julia Child, who did more than just about anyone to change the way Americans cook and eat. Judith Jones was the editor who first published Julia Child. She went on to have a legendary career herself as the editor of dozens of well-known chefs and food writers. Jones looks back over her life with food in a new memoir called The Tenth Muse. She told Steve Paulson, it's hard to convey just how different American attitudes toward food were before Julia.
It certainly was a very different time.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps more than anybody, Julia Child awakened these repressed appetites, because it was too long we'd had this sort of Puritan heritage where food was fodder, and that was that. And about the time I came into the world, gastronomic America was at its lowest point. And what happened after the war, of course, was that not only had the GIs traveled and brought back an appetite for more interesting tastes, but every little secretary was suddenly going to Paris for the first time because there were the new airlines, cheap flights, and it was no longer just for the elite.
Well, you were one of those people who went off to France at an early age. I mean, you went there after college, and my sense is you really discovered the glory of French cooking at that time.
I did, yeah. I was supposed to go for a two-week vacation, and I stayed 3.5 years. Fortunately, my purse was stolen when I was sitting in the Tuileries Gardens and thinking, how am I going to leave this beautiful city? And I just belong here.
And the purse had your return ticket in it as well.
It had everything, my passport, return ticket, traveler's checks, my whole identity. But instead of sort of boohooing and saying, send me some money to come home, I just went out and started looking for a job and decided that it was fate.
Hmm. Now, what was it about the French and food that was so special, that was so different from the environment you grew up in?
Well, for one thing, they shopped 2 or 3 times a day, and they loved it. I can remember one particular time I was standing in the boulangerie, the bread shop. We always got our bread fresh every morning. And there was a man in front of me, and he opened up the baguette, and he cheered, and then he passed the bread around to, there were a lot of people waiting in line, and they all, the cheer just rose higher and higher, and I thought, what is this about? And I asked somebody, and they said, the flour is white. We haven't had white flour since before the war. You would just never have found that in America, that joy in something, that pride, that pure love of food. It was captivating. I just fell for it.
And there were all the specialty shops. I mean, there was the butcher and the baker and the fish shop,
yeah,
and the cheese store and the wine merchant.
And the charcuterie and the fromagerie. And, yep, you spent a good deal of time shopping. And I think I got to know the French in that way. I loved French women. I liked the way they treated their men. So, and one way was feeding them.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that you met your own husband when you were in France. I mean, he was an American, but happened to be over
there. He was an American, and he was discovering food in much the same way. So it was very much a shared thing. And when we came back, we wanted to continue it, but we found it hard because you couldn't find in a supermarket or even a vegetable market things like leeks and shallots and all those things we just take for granted today. Fresh herbs were unheard of, and it was mostly iceberg lettuce. And so It was frustrating. And I also realized how much I didn't know. I had learned a lot from asking people, but I didn't know the techniques of cooking, the finesse, the things that make the big difference between just a good dish and that, as Julia would say, soignée.
It seems to me that we can almost date the year when American culture came to love food. I mean, when French cuisine went mainstream in America, and it was 1961 when Julia Child and her two French co-authors came out with this massive book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
That's
And you played a pivotal role in getting that book published.
Well, somebody else might have done it, but I felt that I was just the right person. We had such sort of parallel careers, Julia and I, because we were in France at the same time. We both fell in love with cooking. It was a kind of rebellion against our families. I mean, and so it was a natural coming together.
Now, it's so fascinating reading about the whole process of getting that book published, because it wasn't as if you were just the editor who came across this great manuscript and there it was, voila, you had the book. I mean, you actually tried a lot of her recipes in your own kitchen. You read, for instance, about making boeuf bourguignon and, you know, seeing what that was like.
And the difference between Julia's instructions, she told you what meat to buy. She told you to use butter plus a little oil because the butter would burn. She told you to dry the meat because you can't brown something if it dries. You mustn't crowd the pan or it steams. Once you learn it, it's part of you. You apply it the next time.
Now, it seems that a lot of the success of that book had to do with Julia Child herself, especially once she got on television, which happened
fairly
soon.
Once she got on television, it was a miracle because I don't think there's been anyone like her since. She was totally natural, unscripted. The wonderful remark she made just came from the gut. And when she picked up the chicken and slapped it and somebody said, "Why do you massage the butter into the chicken?" she'd say, "Well, I think it likes it." And there were so many things like that that just popped out of her mouth. As I say, I think it released something that had been long repressed in people, and that is that food is fun, it's sensuous, it's creative, it's generous. I mean, you're doing it for friends and family. Enjoy it. That was just unheard of.
Now, you came to know Julia Child very well. What was she like?
Oh, she was great fun to be with. I remember once we were visiting in France for Christmas, and I went over to her house to help with the Christmas dinner. And she had a goose. But the important thing, she said, is that the feet are on that goose. I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you want to get the tendons out, because that's what makes the legs tough." And then she took a huge knife or whatever it was and whacked the ankles and put her finger in around the tendon. Then she threw the goose on the floor with a broomstick, and then she pulled and the whole tendon came out, and she said, "Just like pulling out the cork out of a bottle of wine." So it was just wonderful.
Now, later you became the editor of a number of renowned cookbook writers. Claudia Roden, who wrote the classic book of Middle Eastern food. Madhur Jaffrey, who put Indian food on the map in America, and many others as well. Did these various cookbook authors have anything in common?
They did. And I made this discovery that one of the qualities that was so important is that feeling of love for this food. And they were all displaced people. Claudia grew up in Cairo and they had to leave. And so she went to Paris to finish school and then to London. But she longed for the food of her childhood. That brought back her family and memories. And there was always this feeling of the recipe had that story, that history behind it, and that emotional attachment, which I think is very important. Madhur Jaffrey, the same thing. She never went in the kitchen herself, but this large extended family, sometimes as many as 40, sat down to dinner. And there were fabulous dinners. And they were also very good writers because they had to learn from scratch, just as you and I have to learn from scratch. So they understood the home cook. to tell you what to anticipate and how to correct the seasonings and things like that. I found that they were really our best teachers.
And they weren't professional chefs. I mean,
they weren't professional chefs.
They were amateur cooks in a way.
Yeah, yeah. You see, I think the professional chef lives in a whole different world. I know he does. His challenge is to do something dramatic, surprising. He gives us ideas, of course. I mean, I love to go to a restaurant sometimes just to taste something that you want to try to emulate later at home. That isn't home cooking. Home cooking is more a rhythm through the whole week, how you're going to use dishes again. And for the individual, it's really more challenging and creative.
Now, today, you are in your 80s. Your husband mm-hmm. passed away some years back. Do you still do much cooking yourself?
Oh, I did. And I thought at first that I would find that difficult. But it was quite the opposite. I found instead that when I came home in the evening after a day at work, tired, that the one thing I wanted to do was to roll up my sleeves and see what was in the fridge, improvise a bit, and smash the garlic. Then when it's all ready, I love to put it nicely on a plate. I light the candles. I maybe turn on some music. And when I sit down, I'm really not alone. I'm with the past, in a sense, and I'm honoring something that was very important in both of our lives.
This has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm almost feeling evangelical, if you know what I mean. I'm sad that people aren't cooking more because they're missing one of the great pleasures of life.
Judith Jones is senior editor and vice president at Alfred A. Knopf, where she has worked since 1957. Her memoir is called The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Food Stories, number 1125B. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strainchamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
Public Radio International.